We're going to pick up where we left off last time. We are in the period between 200 and 249, so the first half of the third century.
The Monarchian controversy.
What is that? Oh, it's a nice little battle here, but it isn't violent, so sorry to disappoint you there. But it is a debate that occurs during this period at Rome, the city of Rome, during the episcopate of Victor. When I say episcopate, I mean the bishophood or something like that. Okay, comes from episcopos. Okay, so while Victor was bishop there in Rome, and it basically originated in a revolt against the Logos theology that Justin Martyr and the Apologists had propounded. And it has to do with Christology. What is the nature of Jesus, the Son of God? All right. Now, let me give you a couple quotes from Justin Martyr, and maybe you can tell why some people might not like it. Okay. Here's what Justin says in his second apology. He says, "For next to God, we worship and love the Logos," the Word, right? Jesus, "who is out of the unbegotten and ineffable God, since also he became man for our sakes, that becoming a partaker of our sufferings, he might also bring us healing." Now, why is that such a big deal? Because he says there's someone that we worship next to God. All right, here's another passage from him that's even more explicit. He says, "There is, and there is said to be, another God and Lord subject to the Maker of all things, who is also called an angel, because he announces to men whatsoever the Maker of all things, above whom there is no other God, wishes to announce to them. I shall endeavor to persuade you that he who is said to have appeared to Abraham and to Jacob and to Moses, and who is called God, is distinct from him who made all things. I mean numerically, not in will." Now what is he saying here? There is another God, someone called God, who is next to the Maker of all things, the Creator, God. All right? That, he says, is also called an angel, and who appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Moses, and is distinct from God. But he says, only numerically, not in will. In other words, they both want the same things, but numerically they are too. All right. Now, some people didn't like this, okay? Because they're like, "I thought we were monotheists. Aren't we monotheists? Didn't you think we have a monotheistic religion here?" All right. What does that mean? One God. Justin and these guys are talking about two gods. And this is a problem that they kind of had from the beginning that people had all different explanations for, but it didn't really come to a head, and people start really arguing about it until right now. Okay? Justin's already dead. But his view was held by a lot of people. Well, yeah, there's God the Father, and then there's Jesus, and he's also called God. All right? Well, how many gods do you worship? Just one. Well, and Justin's explanation was, well, because they have the same will, they both want the same things, that, what does that amount to? It really only amounts to one God, because the Son does whatever the Father wants. So what's the big deal? But it isn't really a great explanation, and it wasn't satisfying to a lot of people. So there was a rebellion against this idea during this period, particularly in Rome. Okay, they especially didn't like his comment that there's another God. When Justin was arguing against Hellenized Jews who were talking about the Logos, remember the Jewish Philo and all that, he had ideas about the Logos, and the way they had been describing the Logos is that it's like sun and sunlight, okay? It's from the same thing, like the Logos is actually part of God. He's a hypostasis of God, right? It's part of God. It's God, it's a representation of God, like an avatar of God or something like that. But Justin didn't like that because he thought that smushed them together too much and didn't make them distinct enough. So he would say, no, it's more like a torch being lit off another torch. You've got two torches. All right? But it's both from the same fire. All right? So, same fire, But he wants to make sure that they're two. They're distinct. All right? But there were people who didn't like that. Now, see, one of the central issues at the time when they were fighting against Gnosticism is the idea of whether there was only one ultimate source for all of creation. Remember, I even read it when I was reading to you about Apelles, and they were arguing about the one source and all that, the ultimate principle. Because, remember, there were Gnostics and Marcion, too, who would say there are two sources. There's the good, the great God, and then there's the other one who made all the earth and everything. Okay, and he's the source of... So that's more than one source. So everyone said, no, there only can be one source. And the word that they used was monarchia, a single monarchia, basically means... I don't know if you're familiar with Greek philosophy, but let me just say this. There was talk in Greek philosophy about the fundamental principle from which everything comes, and it was called the arche. All right. So when you say monarchia, you're saying there's only one arche. All right. But anyway, so Christians were saying there's only one source. Now, when you talk about there being two gods, all right, that's dietheism. That's two gods, not one. And they didn't like that. Because they don't want two gods. Especially since Jesus is spoken of as being, or the Logos is spoken of as being a creator of the world and all that, like helping God create the world. Okay? So that's another source. So they don't like this idea of the two gods. So there are two different ways you can battle this. One was adoptionism, the other one is modalism. Actually, I probably should tell you about Hippolytus first. I'll say this and I'll come back to him, but Hippolytus supported Justin's point of view. Okay? Except he avoided the language of two gods. Now, I have you reading some of him. Okay? But he avoids the language of two gods. But it's basically still Justin's position. But I'll get to it in a second. I just want to introduce you to all the different views and then I'll talk about how they fought about it. Okay. Monarchianism is either view that, and there's two of them, that posits, okay, there is not two, but only one source. Okay? Only one monarchia. Okay? So two different ways you can go about it. And they're both on opposite ends of the spectrum. They're completely different from one another. The one is adoptionism. Okay? And here's what it is. It suggests that Jesus was merely a human being in every way, okay, until he was adopted by the Father to be his son. And that's when he became the Son of God, and he got all these honors, and he was elevated, and so on and so forth. Okay? But how does that preserve the monarchia? That God the Father is God alone. The Son of God was made into the Son of God by God the Father, but he is not God. Okay? And this view is associated with Theodotus of Byzantium, or as like his opponents preferred to call him, Theodotus the Shoemaker. Because he, lowly profession, so, you know. Oh, the shoemaker, you know what he says. And there's another guy named Artemon that Eusebius mentions, who also holds this view. I think he was a student of Theodotus, Artemon. So that's adoptionism. In the Gospels, when Jesus is baptized, a voice comes out of heaven and says, "This is my Son, the Beloved, whom I have approved," or something like that. And they say, see, he is adopting Jesus as his Son. Okay? Other adoptionists held, though, that he didn't become the Son until he was resurrected, but it was all after he was a man. Okay? And there are other passages from the Bible that they use to show that too. However, those who disagreed with the adoptionists said, well, wait a minute. In the Gospel of John, Jesus is called God. And I believe that may be the only, that is the only gospel that calls him God. I'm trying to think, it's the only book in the New Testament that calls him God. I think that maybe Hebrews might call him God too. So that was why some people couldn't accept this idea. Jesus is clearly called God. Now, it's not done very straightforward. Like it says, there's the most explicit one is where Jesus is resurrected and Thomas says, my Lord and my God. That's the explicit part where Thomas calls Jesus my God. Okay? Jesus doesn't really say, no, I'm not, or yes, I am, but, you know. The other part is in the beginning of John where it says that the Logos was God, right? And then the Logos became flesh, and that's Jesus. So Jesus must be God. That's the other part. So that's one reason why people didn't like the adoptionist movement. I have to say this, though. You say, well, how do the adoptionists deal with the Gospel of John? Well, a lot of them didn't use the Gospel of John. Another thing is the virgin birth story. Justin used to say, he says, look, every virgin birth story that you know of in Greco-Roman mythology, when a virgin gets pregnant, okay, or let's put it this way, when a woman gets pregnant by the gods, the person born is a god, or at least a demigod. So how could you say that Jesus was only a human being if, you know, God and Mary is supposed to have him as a baby? Okay? So that was the other thing for how he has to somehow be divine. So the other view, the alternative view, the opposite extreme, modalism. Okay? Here's the idea. And it was propagated by this Noetus and Sibelius. Okay, Noetus was a presbyter from Asia Minor. Sibelius, we're not exactly sure where he was from, but he's also a presbyter, we think, from Rome. But here's the idea, that there's only one God, only one monarchia, and sometimes he goes by the name Father, and sometimes he goes by the name Son. They're just different modes of the same person. Okay? So God is one person, and sometimes he just has different names. Scholars call that modalism. In those days, they called it Sabellianism. They called it Sabellianism in the West. They called it Patripassianism in the East. Don't you love it when I give you all these words? Patripassianism. What it means is, well, let's see if you can figure it out. Patri, Father. Passion, yeah. The suffering Father. Okay? Meaning you believe that when Jesus was here on the earth and he died, was crucified, that that was the Father. That it was the Father who suffered. Okay? That's why they called them Patripassians. I don't think they would have liked that term, but that's what people called them. Okay? So that's what modalism is. All right? Father and Son are two different modes of the same person. Now, Hippolytus, see, he defended Justin's view. The problem with the what Hippolytus hated particularly about modalism is that it doesn't distinguish Father and Son as actual persons. And so Hippolytus emphasizes the fact that these are two persons. He uses the word prosopon, which means face, but it's two persons. Okay? But he denies, when you read his thing, you'll see, he denies the fact that there are two gods, because everyone's saying, you believe in two gods. And he's like, no, I don't. And he uses the same idea that Justin did. He says, they're united in will. That means they all do the same thing. So, you know, the Father gives an order, the Son does it. He even brings the Holy Spirit into it, but he doesn't call the Holy Spirit a person. He says the Father's a person, the Son's a person, but he doesn't call the Holy Spirit a person. But he says, the Father says it, and then Jesus does it, and the Holy Spirit also somehow does it. So it's really all coming from the same God. So, yeah, they're separate persons, but there's still only one God, so don't get all bent out of shape about it. But people had a hard time with that, and so there's all this fighting going on around the year 215 or so. It actually came to a head. It started during the bishopric of Victor, but then his successor, Zephyrinus, was the next guy, and they also were fighting during this period. And that's around the time that this deacon, Zephyrinus is the bishop of Rome, this deacon named Callistus became involved in the controversy. And Hippolytus, in the thing I have you read in your reader, talks a lot about Callistus, and you can tell that he hates his guts. Talks about all these horrible things about him, a lot of personal attacks. But Callistus was put in charge of a cemetery, I guess, on the Appian Way in Rome. And his role in the debate was to try and come up with a compromise position. And it was a position that none of the sides actually liked. The position was this. The Father was the name of the Spirit dwelling inside of Jesus, and the Son was the human body of Jesus. Okay? No one actually is going to pick up on this, but this is his compromise position. So the Spirit inside is the Father, the body is the Son. And Hippolytus, in the work I have you read, is going to argue against him on that. Okay, but Callistus publicly denounced Hippolytus as a ditheist, okay, meaning you believe in two gods, and Hippolytus didn't like that. And then in the year 217, to the horror of Hippolytus, Callistus was appointed Zephyrinus' successor as Bishop of Rome, and then he was ticked off. So he felt unable to have communion with this man, and he also, there's a number of other things he didn't like that Callistus taught. He talks about those things in the reading. He says that Callistus preached that because there were both clean and unclean animals on Noah's Ark, therefore there can be both clean and unclean people in the church. What Callistus was saying, that if somebody sins gravely after baptism, they should be allowed to stay. But, you know, we'll work on them and everything, but they should be allowed to stay. And Hippolytus didn't like that. Callistus also began to recognize marriages between upper-class women and lower-class men. And Hippolytus didn't like that either. Okay? And also, Callistus began recognizing monogamous concubinage as acceptable. In other words, if you have a concubine, but you're devoted to each other and there's nobody else, that's okay. And Hippolytus didn't like that either. Well, you know, in his work, he says men with concubines, they don't get baptized. All right. But Callistus is saying that's okay. All right. So what Hippolytus does is he separates from Callistus. And some people call him an anti-pope, okay, because Callistus was the, you know, retroactively we're calling him the pope, even though they don't use that word yet. But he's the bishop of Rome. And Hippolytus establishes his own church in Rome in opposition to Callistus. It's probable that the apostolic tradition that we just talked about with baptism was written to that other church that Hippolytus founded. All right. Well, anyway, the monarchian controversy was not ended by any kind of compromise or satisfying conclusion. It just kind of fizzled out, but people were still arguing about it, and there was no resolution, and there was still a diverse number of opinions. All right, but it was the first time there actually was a controversy on this. There will be plenty more. Hippolytus was, after Callistus, I think he outlived Callistus, and there was an agreement made to bring him back in, and I think he ended his life in proper communion with the rest of the church. So, but he had a problem with Callistus. Anyway. So he has, in the writings I gave you, he has one thing that he writes about Callistus and another about Noetus, where he's talking about modalism. And you will notice that he uses the word Trinity. He's not the first. The word Trinity had been used probably since the 2nd century, but we have to be careful not to impose later definitions of Trinity upon the earlier use of the word. The original use of the word is simply to refer to the three entities, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, which was being used in baptisms by that point. All right? They didn't use the word to refer to a doctrine, but only to those three things. So when you talk about, oh, the Trinity, they're talking about the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, without defining what their relationship is. Okay? So just keep that in mind. All right. Early 3rd century polemicists. And both of these guys I'm having you read excerpts of. Tertullian, I've mentioned him a few times already. North Africa is where he's from, and by this time, the region is got a pretty substantial Christian component. By the way, it was one of the principal sources of grain for the empire. Egypt was too. Well, that's part of North Africa. But all of North Africa produced a lot of food for the empire. But Tertullian's from the western part of North Africa. Carthage is now a thriving city once again. It had been destroyed hundreds of years earlier, but now it is kind of back. It's still a Roman city, though, but it is now a very important, second to Rome as far as on the western side of the Mediterranean, the second biggest city next to Rome. So it's doing quite well. And Tertullian didn't live far from there. But there was a substantial proportion of the population that were not the original African inhabitants. They were Greeks who migrated there. Okay. How Christianity got to North Africa is not clear, but probably it was in the middle of the second century where missionaries came there and started founding churches. Tertullian's numerous writings, and they're in Latin, by the way, so is Hippolytus, I forgot to mention that, reveal little about the history of North Africa, but they tell us a little bit about, well, actually a lot about Christian ideas. And Tertullian has a very sarcastic tone. He's not like Justin Martyr, who's trying to get on his audience's good side. You know, Justin Martyr is, when he's dealing with pagans and trying to talk to them, he's trying to reason with them. Tertullian is very intolerant of pagan ideas, and he just totally trashes them. You know, he just comes down on them and makes fun of them, and he'll do personal attacks. He does that, but that makes him more interesting to read, okay? Because he's just nasty. Otherwise, you would find him extremely boring, but because he's so cutting, you know, he's more interesting to read. So I call him a polemicist because he's not exactly an apologist. He's not so much defending Christianity as attacking paganism. All right. Anyway, every page of his works are written with the joy of inflicting some kind of discomfort on his adversaries for their errors. But what we're interested in is that he was very concerned that Christianity would be contaminated by pagan ideas. He's not like Justin Martyr. Justin Martyr accepts a lot of Greco-Roman ideas and says, oh yeah, we're kind of alike, you know. But Tertullian doesn't want to have anything to do with that, and he's very purist when it comes to Christianity. Okay? So he says Christians should keep themselves completely spotless from the corruption of the world. And they should stay away, for example, from the theater and all the public shows. They shouldn't serve in the army or in any civil service or even in schools. Christians shouldn't even have jobs in an occupation that would be even indirectly attached to idolatry. So his view of the Christian life is first and foremost a battle with the devil that you have to win. Okay, so there are no compromises. He often uses arguments that are fallacious and they don't add up logically. He'll resort to personal attacks, but hey, that's part of the fun. He was also indifferent to public approval. He doesn't care who is on his side. Go ahead and hate me, so what? You know, that was his attitude. Now, the interesting thing about it, though, is that he was or became a Montanist. Told you about Montanism before? You know, the New Prophecy movement? All right, he believed that stuff. And a lot of people didn't like him about it. And he will eventually be declared a heretic and removed from communion with the church. But anyway, before I talk about that some more, it was his need to combat monarchianism that made him write a work, a tract, against a certain guy named Praxius. And he talks about the monarchian controversy. So he wasn't in Rome, but he was interested in what was going on there. And there were some people in North Africa that had some of these ideas too. And so Praxius was a modalist. He was a Sabellian. Okay? And Tertullian came up with his own idea about how things work between the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. Now, one way that Tertullian differs from Hippolytus is that he believes that the Holy Spirit is a person, and he uses the word persona, okay, person in Latin, for the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So clearly at this time, there were some people who thought the Holy Spirit was a person, and there were other people who did not. Okay, but anyway, his is the first formulation of something that somewhat resembles the later Trinity doctrine that we'll see in the 4th century. He says that all three, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, are one. Now, He calls them three and he calls them one. Now, what does he mean by that? And he says, they are one substantia, but three personas. Personae. Now, what does substantia mean? Good question. If you're going to do a literal translation, it would be substance. Okay? But it could also mean character, nature. All right? So we don't really know what he meant. Okay? But substantia. So, you know, you see one substance, one character, one nature. So he leans towards a Hippolytus's idea, but it's a little bit more, a little bit further development towards the later Trinity doctrine. Now, neither of these words will be used in the Trinity formulation of the 4th century, because that's in Greek, okay? But they don't even use Greek exact Greek equivalents to these. They're kind of like these, but not exactly, okay? But it's something partially resembling that anyway. Okay, too bad I can't really tell you what a substantia is in his mind. Anyway, that's Tertullian's idea of how the relationship of these three work together. What's interesting is that he does bring the Holy Spirit into it, and Hippolytus does it to a certain extent too, but most of the writers of this period are just concerned about Father and Son. They don't really talk so much about the Holy Spirit. That's only sometimes. But Tertullian's one of them. Anyway, because Tertullian was into Montanism. Actually, it wasn't so much that he was kicked out of the church because of it. It's he decided to leave the church. He's like, you guys aren't listening to me. I'm trying to convince you of this, and you don't want to hear it. Fine, I'll go elsewhere, you know. So he kind of leaves. But what's weird is that even though he lived the rest of his life kind of outside the mainstream church, his writings, his theology will be used by future generations. All right? For example, Jerome. Jerome is a guy from the 4th century. He relates an anecdote where another fellow named Cyprian, both of these guys I'm going to tell you about, called Tertullian the master. Cyprian, by the way, was from North Africa, but he looked at Tertullian as, like, he's the master when it comes to writing about Christian theology. This is the guy right here. So looking up to him. You know, a lot of people looked up to him in North Africa in particular. Many turns of phrase and terms that Tertullian used will be used as part of the vocabulary, particularly of the Western Christian world, the Western half of the Mediterranean. So he's very influential that way.
Minucius Felix.
I gave you quite a long work to read by Minucius Felix, and I apologize if it was too much for you, but it's kind of interesting. And I wanted you to read it because he's trying to defend Christianity against accusations against it. And he attacks paganism, but you get to see a lot of the objections that people had against Christianity during this period and how Christians might answer those objections. So you get to see, like, kind of one point of view and the other point of view and how they interacted with each other. Anyway, he was more conciliatory in tone than Tertullian, okay? He's a little bit nicer, and maybe for that reason he's not as interesting, but he lived around the same time. And he wrote this work called The Octavius, which is about a conversation between a Christian named Octavius and a polytheist named Caecilius. They're walking along the beach, and they're having a conversation. Now, Minucius is not presenting anything really independent or original here. He's just presenting kind of common objections and arguments from both sides. But that's good for us because we get to see some common things that people were saying on either side of the fence. He draws very freely from people like Plato and Virgil and a lot of Cicero, and especially, though, Tertullian. He presents Tertullian's arguments basically in a much nicer manner. Okay, more polite manner, I should say. He's so tactful in his writings that he almost hardly uses the word Christ or Bible in his writings. All right? He's trying to present it in a very palatable way to the pagan audience. Okay? So that's why I'm having you read him. Oh, here's a work, how Christianity's been spreading now and since the last time I showed you. The dark spots are where, of course, they're by 300. Now, we're not quite at 300 yet. Okay, we got about 50 years to go. But by 300, the dark spots there are where there are more than 50% of the population Christian. All right? And 30 to 50% somewhere in the lighter shaded areas. Now, I don't entirely agree with this. Because I just read a book. I just got it last week. And I read this new book. And they were counting up all the archaeological sites where there were churches, figuring out how many people were in those churches, comparing it with the known populations of the area, and the percentage of Christians seems to be a lot smaller than what this map is saying. So I wouldn't take that 50% or 30 to 50% too seriously. However, it probably is accurate when it comes to the density of Christians in those areas. I mean, it's not going to be 50% of the population, but there will be more Christians in those darker spots than in the lighter spots. But anyway, just shows you that it's very difficult to count Christians, okay, from so long ago. And then I want to show you this. The Aleximenos Graffito. And on the left, you see an actual picture of it, and then you can see a drawing of it on the right. Now, what is this? Well, let me introduce this first by saying that there was an accusation that was popular during this time that Christians practice what we call onolatry. Not a word I'm going to quiz you on. Onolatry. Does anyone have any guess what it might mean? The worship of donkeys. And people were accusing Christians of worshiping donkeys. Where did this come from? Well, what's interesting is that there was a tutor of Marcus Aurelius, the emperor, a guy by the name of Fronto, who lived just a little bit earlier than this period. A lot of his arguments against Christians, or his accusations against Christians, are preserved in the Octavius. All right? And one of those is, and this is from the Octavius, the religion of the Christians is foolish inasmuch as they worship a crucified man and even the instrument itself of his punishment. They are said to worship the head of an ass, and even the nature of their father. All right? That's from the Octavius. And we believe it comes from Fronto. But here we have them saying that, well, they're worshiping the head of an ass. All right? And then there is this account in Tacitus from the late first century. Okay, this is way back. But there's a story in there where Tacitus recounts how the Jews, after being expelled from Egypt, wandered around in the desert, just talking about the Exodus, okay, exhausted and dying of thirst, and they were following a herd of wild asses that led them to water. And he says that they then erected in the temple at Jerusalem an image of the animal that had delivered them, an ass. That, in turn, led to an idea that somehow the Christians worshipped an ass. And Tertullian says this too. He says, people think that our God has an ass's head. So now, when we look at this graffiti here, you can understand maybe why it looks like it does. It, by the way, it was found carved into plaster on a wall near the Palatine Hill in Rome. And it's thought to be the earliest ever representation of Jesus on the cross. Okay? But not by a Christian. The cross, you may not know this, but the cross was not actually used in Christian worship until the 4th and 5th centuries. And it wasn't used in Christian art until the 6th century. Okay? It's one of the reasons why we believe this is actually not a Christian depiction, although it is about Christians, probably. But we don't really actually have any evidence of any Christian art where they have crosses. And in the literature, there's not much talk of crosses. And we don't have any artifacts of crosses from churches until the 4th or 5th century. It's possible that earlier they were starting to use it. But we believe that because the crucifixion... Well, let's say you saw a picture of a guy hanging from a noose, you know, being hanged to death. You know, like that, whatever. That, is, in the early days, is more likely to be a dig at the guy who's being executed than it is to say, oh, isn't he great? You know what I'm saying? And that's why we think that when we see something like this, where there's a guy on a cross, they're actually making fun of Jesus, you know, rather than saying he's great. Now, what you see here is a human-like figure attached to a cross, and he's got the head of an ass. In the top right, there's an image of what we believe to either be the Greek letter upsilon or a tau. There's still debate about that. But to the left of the image, you see a young man, and he's supposed, we think he's this guy, Alexamenos, who's mentioned in the inscription. And he seems to be, he's raising one hand in a gesture suggesting worship of the man donkey on the cross. Okay. But the inscription says, well, literally it says, Alexamenos, worship God, as an imperative. But some people think that it may mean Alexamenos worshiping his God. And this is supposed to be a dig at Christians, you know. There's no clear consensus as to the date of this graffito, but we think that it's somewhere between the 1st and 3rd centuries, and I'm putting it in here. It seemed appropriate right after Minucius Felix because of the accusation about them worshiping an ass. But this is kind of around the time period probably that it was up, but we really can't date it much more narrowly than that. Okay, it was found, by the way, in a building that was used as a boarding school for imperial page boys. Don't know what that means, but somebody wrote it on the wall. Okay. Oh, and then there was in the next chamber, there was another inscription that said, Alexamenos is faithful. Just, that's all. So we think it's kind of like a mockery kind of thing, like referring back to the picture, you know, but it was in the next room. What that means, you know, we're not certain, but wanted to mention that too. So there you have it, the Alexamenos graffito. Now, I want to talk a little bit about pagan philosophical reflections during this period. There's some new ideas that come out, and these will have a bearing and influence on the church, so that's why I'm bringing them up. During the period that we're talking about, there was a growing tendency, at least among the more educated urban classes, to judge religious ideas by a philosophical standard. I talked a little bit about that before, but particularly during this period, and this development is spearheaded by, was spearheaded by the Middle Platonists I told you about, and the Cynics, but it's coming even more to the fore now. For example, the ancient myths and the mysteries and the rituals were now frequently being censored, I guess would be the best word, to remove anything ethically objectionable in them. See, even the polytheists themselves, when they're reading their own myths, they're a little uncomfortable with some of those things. The gods doing this or that, and they will edit out the parts that they don't think are very ethically appropriate. Okay? So that's been happening. Serious efforts were made to also rationalize and reconcile some of the conflicting ideas in the various pagan works. Sometimes there'll be contradictions and they're trying to reconcile them. So there's more of an interest than there was in ancient times to kind of have everything more harmonious, because philosophy is having an effect on their religious ideas. How did they reconcile some of these myths? One very popular way of doing it is through allegorical interpretation of the myths. In other words, don't take the stories too literally. They have a higher meaning. And that higher meaning is what's really true and valuable about it. So they were really trying to put together a comprehensive and integrated theology. Pagan gods themselves were evaluated as being either good gods or evil gods. You know, when you look at them, they're kind of, a lot of them are like right in the middle, you know, and they're not, sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad, and so it's hard to do that, but they're trying to categorize them. Oh, this is a god that's good. He's got, you know, qualities that you can look up to. This god is evil. He's bad. You don't want to be like him. Oracles and shrines and supposed talking idols and other gimmicks that had been done for centuries were debunked, okay, demythologized, condemned even, okay? And they even actually were starting to reject the idea of using idols at all. Okay? Yes, you can believe in the gods and worship them, but how about in a more spiritual way without the actual statues? Now, I want to emphasize that this is being done by the intellectuals, the urban elites, not the country folk or somebody like that. All right? The educated people. And in particular, they had an abhorrence towards animal sacrifices. They were starting to criticize that as well. The old local and regional shrines came to be more and more neglected, particularly in the cities. People just weren't going to them anymore, like they used to anyway. When the communities in the middle of the 3rd century were trying to defend themselves against confiscations by government agencies, because the government needed money sometimes, so they would go to various temples and shrines to try to get some goods, you know, some gold and things like that. Many of these communities began to build up walls around their towns because they didn't want, you know, Roman soldiers coming in and taking things. So they would actually are defending themselves against their own government, but also, I should mention, barbarian pillagers who would also show up from time to time. But you never used to have walls around your towns during the nice, peaceful period in Roman history, and now you are. And many of the shrines were taken apart and used to build these walls. Okay? Now you might say, well, aren't they trying to prevent people from taking stuff out of their shrines? Well, they're preventing people from taking the valuable stuff, but the shrines themselves aren't as important. Okay? The building is not as important as what's in them, you know. You want to keep your treasures. So oftentimes these temples would be dismantled and used to build walls. Now, why would that be happening? It's because they're not being used that much anymore. So what I'm trying to tell you is that more and more in this period, the worship of the gods is becoming less and less emphasized, or they're less enthusiastic about it. Urban polytheism developed a more henotheistic approach. Anyone know what henotheism is? I'm not going to quiz you on this word, but you know what it is?
Is it one God above many?
Yes, that's correct. The elevation of one God over the others. So it's not like monotheism where there is only one God, but it's you have a supreme God. All right? The various cults around the empire were competing for who gets to be the supreme God, right? You know, because there's all different gods that you can choose from, and a lot of these are labeled good gods. Who are you going to identify with the supreme God? The most common, of course, would be like Jupiter / Zeus, you know. But interestingly, in the 3rd century, even the storm god was not being considered the supreme god. They were starting to identify the supreme god with the sun. S-U-N, the sun, you know, the big yellow thing. The sun as the supreme god. For example, right in the middle of the century, emperors Claudius II and Aurelian each put forward different sun god cults as the protectors of the Roman state. All right. Now, there must have already been kind of an assumption that the sun god was supreme, and that's why they were able to do that, but it shows the importance of the sun god during this period. Right. So here you have the urban people becoming more and more sophisticated with regard to their religion. But when they looked outside the cities and saw people out in the countryside, the peasants, the villagers, the farmers, they looked at them kind of as country hicks, you know, and they gave them the term pagan. And this is where the term pagan comes from originally. It's a word that polytheists gave to other polytheists. All right? But it would be a derogatory term. It's derisive. This is what I'm trying to get at with the difference between paganism and Hellenism. What I just described to you, the intellectual way of approaching polytheism, we call that Hellenism. The non-intellectual approach, the old way, the traditional folk religion, the religion of the country hicks, so to speak, they called paganism. Now, why have I been using the word pagans to refer to all of them? It's because in later times, The Christians picked up on this word pagan, which was derogatory, and they applied it to all polytheists. And so it has come into the English language, meaning anyone who is a polytheist. Okay? But I'm telling you where the word originally came from. And it was some polytheists calling the other polytheists by this name. Does that make sense? Let's talk about some new interesting movements, religious movements in this period. Mithraism. Mithras is the name of the god of this religion. Mithras. Where does he come from? Well, it's a good question. Originally, we thought that Mithras was a Persian religion that got imported into the Mediterranean through, you know, travelers and people like that. But the iconography of Roman Mithraism does not match either the mythology or the iconography of the Persian worship of a god named Mithra. Didn't he fight Godzilla or something like that? Anyway, no, there's a god Mithra in Persia. Is he the same as Mithras in Rome? Probably not. Okay, we thought that. But there's, for example, see that picture up there in the upper right? There's Mithras slaying a bull. Very common theme in the iconography of this cult. There is neither any of this in the material remains in Persia, nor is there any mythology describing Mithra, the Persian god, as doing any of this stuff. So the connection doesn't seem to be there. It may just be a coincidence that the two gods' names sound so much alike. All right. Our earliest evidence for these Mithraic religious rites comes from 67 BCE with Plutarch, who says that a band of pirates based in Cilicia, that's on the southeastern coast of Asia Minor, were practicing the secret rites of Mithras. So that's our earliest literary reference to the cult, 67 BCE. The earliest physical remains of the cult date from around the end of the 1st century CE. It reached its height of popularity, however, in this period that we're talking about right now. And it was practiced or participated in mainly by soldiers. The soldiers liked this cult. But also there were other men involved in it too. By the way, it's exclusively for men. Women were not allowed into the cult. And it's what we would categorize as a mystery cult. Remember we talked about the mysteries before? The initiation rites were secretive. No one talked about it. It was all done kind of underground, so to speak. So that's our problem in trying to understand Mithraism. We don't know everything they did because we don't have any documentation of it. They purposely don't have any documentation of it. They didn't want anyone to know about it. All right? There are rumors that we hear about with some people, you know, writing about it on the outside who were not part of it. Because if they were part of it, they would have been sworn to secrecy. All right? So there, we don't know everything that they say is true.
Was it more lower class soldiers or was it animals involved?
There were both upper class and lower class men involved in it. Okay? But soldiers mainly were lower classes. Now, why am I mentioning this? Well, first of all, the fact that it is a mystery cult links it with Christianity because that's how the Romans viewed Christianity. They thought it was a mystery cult along the same lines as Mithraism. But there's more to it than that. All right? We find some similar iconographic representations in Christian places of worship and catacombs and, you know, burial places like that, as we find here in the Mithras cult. So, for example, part of the Mithras myth is that he died, he was killed, and was resurrected and ascended to heaven. All right? And there'll be depictions of Mithras ascending to heaven. All right? And the way he is depicted, the symbols that they use, the way they draw him, and it would have been great if I would have had a couple of images side by side, but I don't, but I'll have to remember to do that for next time. But the way he's depicted as ascending to heaven, very, very similar to what we see in Christian iconography for Jesus ascending to heaven after he was crucified. All right. Now, why is that? Well, all it means is that, you know, these artistic representations, they were influencing each other. All right. They borrow from each other. They're like, oh, this is a cool idea. They're also, for example, when Mithras is very much associated with the stars, and you'll see like the various representations of the heavenly bodies up on the, like, the ceilings of these underground places of worship. And a lot of that imagery you also find in some early Christian church meeting places. So that's interesting. Some people go overboard and they say, oh, well, you know, Christianity totally copied Mithraism. You know, we don't know enough about Mithraism to be able to make a judgment in that regard, so we can't go that far. But we do see some influence, at least as with regard to the art. All right. By the way, the picture that you see up here on the upper right, if you can see more of it, it would be a little bit more obvious, but often you'll see him slaying this bull inside of a cave. And in fact, caves are where they had these places of worship of Mithras. We call them a Mithraeum. Makes sense, right? So if you hear about a Mithraeum, that's a place where they worship Mithras. But it's usually in caves because they wanted it to be out of the way, kind of, and they're secret places that no one kind of knew where they were, you know. It's a typical mystery cult. You all have secret, you know, handshakes and stuff like that. Well, not handshakes, but you understand what I'm talking about. We also believe that the worshippers would have gathered for common meals together, which is similar to Christianity. They had like a little meal, just like the Christians did. We know that from the archaeology. There are like tables and benches around it inside the Mithraeum. So they too had interesting rituals involving food and drink, much like the Christians did. Neoplatonism. This is a great example of a very eclectic philosophy. Do you know what I mean by eclectic? It's a word a college student should know. You know what eclectic means? Very good. Yes, derived from a variety of sources. Okay. Give that gentleman an A. No. I'm just kidding. I don't give out A's that easily. Okay. Right. So it's eclectic in the sense it draws from a bunch of different philosophies. Now, in this particular case, it draws from, you might say, well, these aren't different philosophies. Platonism and Middle Platonism, but they do slightly differ. I told you about Middle Platonism already. The teachings of Aristotle, Stoicism, and also even some biblical ideas. What's different about Neoplatonism compared to Middle Platonism and Early Platonism is that it can be classified not simply as a philosophy, but as a religion. You know, I use the word philosophy and religion very strictly to mean philosophy is teaching about the universe, about life or whatever, but without reference to a god. Once you have a worship of a god involved, it becomes a religion. Okay? Neoplatonism had the worship of God in it, so that's why I'm calling it a religion, even though it's heavily influenced by philosophy. It had some ideas in it that you might think sound very Gnostic, but we don't call it Gnosticism at all because, well, first of all, it's not Christian, and I'm usually reserving that term for a Christian heresy. But you'll notice some interesting similarities. The founder of this philosophy is a guy named Plotinus. Okay, he's the guy who came up with it, and there he is there on the bottom left. So, ahead of him, and apparently maybe he probably did look something like that. The man on the right is not Porphyry. We'll get to him. He's somebody else. Okay, so anyway, basic to Plotinus's view was the premise that all knowledge is the result of divine revelation. It's similar to Gnosticism in that way, right? It also comes from Plato. Although Plato doesn't have God involved quite as much. But it's associated with the spiritual, obviously, in Plato. So he basically systematizes how it is that divine revelation comes to people, and then he teaches you how to get it. All right? So what he does is he divides reality into four components, four categories. Okay? And they are, the top category is one. That's God. He's above all existence. Okay? Transcendent. The highest there can be. And there's no way that a human down here, okay, is going to be able to relate to the one because he is just too far removed from us. The word is transcendent. Okay? But below one is what we call mind. And he says that's just pure intellect. But the point is that one emanates mind. So mind comes from the one. Okay? It's complete knowledge of everything, I guess you could say the mind is. Okay, but it's thought. That emanates soul. Okay? Soul is reason, basically. So mind emanates soul, and then finally soul emanates nature. Okay? And that's the physical world. Physical world, everything you see. So if a human wants to connect and get knowledge from the one, all right, you got to go through these stages. And he shows you how in his book. His book is called The Enneads. How to do that. Okay? Of course, he used reason. This is very much like Plato. You know, reason understands the forms. He actually uses the language of forms in the same way that Plato does. And so your reason is how you can understand these things, and that's how you work your way up. But he basically teaches you how to do that. Okay? It's a very individualistic religion. It's not one that has churches or something and you all do it together. It's a very much an individual experience. Neoplatonists believe that human perfection and happiness is attainable in this world without waiting for an afterlife. And he basically takes perfection and happiness and makes them synonyms. All right, but you can achieve it, and you do it through contemplation, meditation, things like that. All right. One idea that he had that highly influences Christianity, at least the thought of Augustine, who we'll be talking about later, is the idea that evil does not have an independent existence. Evil is not a substance. It's not something that it doesn't exist. Evil is simply the absence of good. He taught that, and this is going to be something that we'll find coming into Christianity as a result. Okay. In fact, Augustine was himself a Neoplatonist before he became a Christian. All right, another thing. This idea about one source. Remember, we're talking about this a lot, about is there a single source for all existence? Or are there like other emanations of God that are imperfect, that created this world, and so on and so forth? He's against that. He says there's a single source. And also that when you die, you are reunited with the source. So you come out of it and you go back to it. Because Plotinus, however, was so influential, and a lot of people liked him, a lot of people wrote along Neoplatonic lines after him, changing some ideas here, changing some ideas there. So it's hard to just say, here's Neoplatonism, because if you looked at all the different writers, there are different ideas, more like Neoplatonisms than it is singular. But it also is important to know that because of this, there's not going to be, when you have Christians, for example, engaging with it and talking about it, they're not all going to approach it the same way, as if it's the same thing, because they have different ideas about what it is. I don't think you're actually going to be reading much Christian literature about Neoplatonism directly, but you'll see it influenced by that. Now, who's Porphyry? He was a student of Plotinus. He studied in Athens before he joined up with Plotinus, and then Plotinus converted him to Neoplatonism somewhere in the 260s. So it's a little bit after this period, but Porphyry said that Plotinus saved him from suicide. He was so depressed, he said, he was going to kill himself. And then he learned Neoplatonism, and he decided he wanted to live. Anyway, it's Porphyry who actually collected all of Plotinus's writings and put them into this book called the Enneads. It refers to the nines, and it's organized according to the number nine. There's 9 books in it. We think that's Porphyry's divisions, though not Plotinus's. But even though Porphyry was not really an original thinker, he did come out with a very important work when it comes to Christianity. He wrote a book called Against the Christians. So this is the next big guy after Celsus now, who's writing a book against Christians. And it's a work, well, not anymore, but because we don't have it all, but originally it was 15 volumes. Huge. And it wasn't directed against Jesus per se, but it was directed against the Christians of his own time. And also the Bible. In fact, Porphyry's attacks on the Bible are precursors to what, even to what you see today. You know, when people talk about, oh, Bible contradictions or whatever. He's the first guy who really comes up with all this stuff. Okay? Talking about who wrote what, and this isn't really, you know, this claims to be by so-and-so, but it really isn't. Oh, look at this contradiction here. Historical analysis of the Bible, finding things wrong with it. He's one of the first to do this. Okay? His book was banned in the 5th century by Christians. Now the whole Roman world was Christian at that time. And they were a lot of the all the copies were destroyed. So how do we know what he said? We have quotations of him in many Christian works who were trying to respond to his book. So all kinds of quotations. So they've been collected by people, and you can see, kind of get a little idea of some of the things he wrote. So I put him in here in your reader, and there are all kinds of selections from Porphyry in no particular order. I organized them, but we don't really know what order he said these. Okay, but you get an idea about his personality and the kind of attacks on Christianity you might find during this period. All right? All right. See you next time.